Has anyone ever lied to you and then you believed it? You know, maybe you had reservations, but you discounted your reservations and bought in anyway. Lies generally impact us in an incredibly personal way. There was a news clipping that came across the internet, oh, maybe a month or so back, not too long ago, from Canada. And it really struck me because it kind of made a sense of outrage in my own mind come out. And then as you watch this play out, it was astounding. But it says, and I apologize, I'm not trying to just shock you, but it says, boy watches in terror as teens hang dog. It says, 10-year-old boy had to watch in horror Saturday afternoon as the dog he had grown up with was hanged by some playground equipment from some playground equipment by a group of teens. I've never dealt with anything like this before, said Constable Mike Mould of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. This is quite disturbing to think that people could do something like this. The attack happened at the schoolyard in the Edmonton suburb of St. Albert. The boy was playing with his dog, Sheba, on the slide around 2 p.m. when the teens approached. Mould said the teens took the 8-year-old German Shepherd cross and the boy used the leash to hang it from the top of a piece of equipment. When the police arrived, the dog was dead. Other news articles followed day by day on this. This one, brutality of dog killing sparks outrage. Reward money pours in to help find teen culprits. People from across North America are so disgusted with a group of teenagers who hanged the boy's dog Saturday at a St. Albert school, they're offering a reward to find them. And again, an article follows. And then finally, the next day after that, boy made up story of dog's death. Animal killed when leash caught on playground equipment. It was a sad story made so much worse by a lie. The police believed it. People across North America believed it. And they were so outraged, they donated thousands of dollars in reward money and sent cards of condolences to the family. The media believed it and covered it as a legitimate news story. It was just a 10-year-old boy's fib. He admitted Monday it was a terrible accident. He told police Sheba died after her leash caught on the playground equipment. Now, when I first read that, I was outraged. And then I watched the follow-up stories come across the lines and how people literally were donating thousands of dollars to find these people, these kids. And then it turns out it was just a lie. And again, it was tragic and terrible. And you felt like you had been somehow cheated or abused, that this lie had been told, you bought into it, and then you found out indeed it wasn't true. Ann Landers had a column a long time ago. I can't tell how long ago, well, it was quite a while back, but they don't change the picture of these ladies. And so they never age, you know. Their wisdom gets better, I assume, but they never age. And she asked for everybody to send in what they thought the best lies were and things that are used as excuses, and then she made a list of them. I promise to pay you back out of my next paycheck was one. You made it yourself? I never would have guessed. Probably a dress or something you can imagine. Oh, your hair looks wonderful. You know, these are all listed in here. Of course I'll respect you in the morning. That's a major lie. Yeah, this one. Your hair looks just fine. It's delicious, but I can't eat another bite. You ever had to sneak something to the trash can? You know, you had to kind of wait till nobody's looking, kind of fold it up in a little napkin or something, just kind of slip it, make it look like it's no longer on your plate. That's never happened at our house. I just heard that happen someplace. I don't know whose that has happened to. Go ahead, tell me. I promise I won't get mad. The river never gets high enough to flood this piece of property. So glad you stopped by. I wasn't doing anything. That's what I say all the time. Oh, yeah, come on in. Dad, I need to move out of the dorm into an apartment of my own so I can have some peace and quiet when I study. You can tell me I won't breathe a word to a soul. The puppy won't be any trouble, Mom. I promise. I'll take care of it myself. That has been at my house. I'm a social drinker. I can quit any time I want. Or this is a good one. I used it last night right when I was called. We have intercoms in the house, and so when dinner time or something, they just buzz the intercom and said, come on up, time for dinner. And I go, oh, here's the story. I'll be there in a minute, or I'll do it in a minute. Somehow a minute to me is, you know, an incomprehensible amount of time. You can stretch it out remarkably. Lies have a terrible, terrible impact. Lies come from Satan. Satan's the father of lies. And lies are used by Satan to be in direct opposition to the truth, to confuse, to obstruct, to turn people aside from making the proper choice. John chapter 8 gives Satan his account in terms of where the lies come from. Christ here is having a discussion. It says in John 8, verse 31, Jesus said to those Jews who believed him, the word believed here is more than they accepted what he said, but these are Jews who are beginning to build a certain amount of trust or relationship or dependence on what he said. So it's a little more than he said, 2 + 2 = 4, and somebody said, well, I believe that. And so Christ here is talking to Jews who began to relate to him in some way more than just casual. And then he said, if you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed. It's not enough to just believe something or to understand something, but if you at least and you indeed do what I say, then you truly become a disciple, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Now, these same people then began to contend with Christ in terms of the fact that, well, we're already free. We already have what we need in that way. We're not captive to any man. And so Christ began to contend with them and say, look, you are of your father, and I am of my father. Your father is the devil. My father is God. And they didn't appreciate that at all. But it goes on down. Verse 39, they answered and said to him, Abraham is our father. Jesus said, if you were Abraham's children, you'd do the works of Abraham. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. Abraham did not do this. You do the deeds of your father. Then he said to him, well, we weren't born of fornication. We have one father, God. And Jesus said, if God were your father, you would love me. For I proceeded forth and came from God. Nor have I come of myself, but he sent me. Why do you not understand my speech? Because you are not able to listen to my word. In other words, these people had gone so far that they had not actually crossed the line over now into obedience and discipleship in that way. You do the deeds of your father. Jesus said, if God were your father, you would love me. Verse 44, you are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. And so Christ made a distinction between his way, which is the truth, the way of God, and the lie, what I will call for the purposes of this sermon, the big lie, which is the way of Satan. Satan has his own institutions. He has social movements. He has religious institutions. He has national identities and belief systems that are all in place. And at the heart of each one of his institutions is a lie, a big lie. It's a big lie that stands in direct opposition to the truth or to what God is actually trying to do. Sometimes even people who know better still buy into the big lie. Now, the big lie in the Garden of Eden is real easy to spot. Genesis 3. Right in the beginning, because there's a very clear statement in terms of what God said, Satan comes back and counters it and tells a big lie, which is the exact opposite. Exodus 3, verse number 1. The serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden. And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor touch it, lest you die. So God said, do not sin, do not turn against me, or you will die. And the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. That was the big lie. He says, it won't happen to you. Don't even give it a thought. Go ahead and do as you please. God said they would die. Satan said they would not. You will not surely die. They bought into the lie. They sinned. And death came upon them as a result. There was also a big lie when God was delivering Israel out of Egypt. We can see it very clearly in the account. But first, if we see what the truth is, then the lie is very, very obvious in opposition to that. Exodus 3, we have the account of the burning bush and God giving Moses instruction in terms of what his purpose with Israel now is going to be. Exodus 3, verse 1. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert, came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Now in the course of this, God calls out to Moses, and Moses comes near, and God introduces himself in verse number 6. He said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them to a land, a good and a large land, a land flowing with milk and honey. I'm going to bless them, prosper them, protect them, guide them, and they're going to do well. It will be an incredible blessing to the people in the land, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. That's the truth. That's what God said he would do. Satan, though, went to Israel and told them a big lie, which was just the opposite of what God said, to confuse them, to distort their vision and perspective, to cause them to turn aside. Now, Israel begins to spout that lie, and that's how we know where it is in the record. We don't actually have the account in this case of Satan saying so, but look in Exodus 14. Notice Israel's response to God's willingness to deliver them from bondage. Exodus 14, Israel is bunched up against the Red Sea. Pharaoh and his armies are coming up behind in a very threatening manner, although God's protection is right there between them, and they have suffered absolutely no harm. They're totally under God's control. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel. And he told them where to camp. Verse 3, for Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. He says, then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. I'll gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. Verse number 9. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea. Verse number 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, so they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they parrot now the lie that Satan told them. They said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in this wilderness. And Moses now contends back. He said, listen, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see no more forever. The truth was, I have come down to deliver you. The lie was, you can't really go and serve God. It just won't work. You can't go out there in the wilderness. Isn't that the same lie that Satan told us when God called us ourselves? Didn't he say something like, well, you can't possibly tithe. If you keep the Sabbath and the holy days, you're going to lose your job. You can't trust God to heal you. You can't trust God to protect you, to guide you. It just won't work. You're better off to just stay where you are. And when Satan first told us that, most of us probably did, temporarily, stay just right where we were. But God kept calling and drawing us, and eventually we then turned to respond. Satan tells the big lie to counter God's word and his truth. And every institution of this world, society, religion, cultural identity of this world has at its heart and core a fundamental lie that Satan has put in place. Now, there's many, many lies that are then built on top of that as well, but there's always one at the heart and core. When we're sick, when we're discouraged, or when we're afraid, the big lie is, well, there really isn't any hope. It's not going to work anyway. You might as well just give up. The truth is that God is an incredibly merciful God and that all things work together for good. Satan comes in with a lie to constantly turn us back from the truth. Darlene made it to services today there in the back. And first holy day, Thursday, our prayer request was made on her behalf because she was sick at home and she had some internal hemorrhaging. She was passing blood and was very, very weak. And so after services, I went over to anoint her, and family and I are all driving down the dirt road up to their house, and lights were flashing everywhere. There was two fire trucks and an ambulance out front. And when we pulled up, it was almost like emergency personnel were just swarming back and forth. And they brought her out on a stretcher, looking very, very weak and pale. In fact, looking weak enough that in your mind you said, I wonder if she's going to make it. And I was able to just catch her just a moment as they put her in the vehicle and just said, Darlene, I'm here. I'll be at the hospital. I'll catch up with you, because I couldn't stop and anoint her right in the middle of the process. And so we did. We went down to the hospital after the emergency vehicles went on down. And I got to where I was able to anoint her there in the emergency room. She was very, very dehydrated, in extreme amount of pain. She had still considerable internal bleeding. I think they gave her 2 units of blood that evening at the hospital to try to replace some of the blood loss, fluid to replace the fluid loss, and to help her with the pain. And so I anointed her that evening, and she was able to relax a little bit and rest some, and waiting for the test the next day so they could find out what this disturbance or this problem had been. They did a colonoscopy and a scope. To put it in the vernacular, they checked her on both ends. And they did a colonoscopy and a scope. You know what they found? Nothing. Nothing. It was clean. There were no sores. There was no cancer. There was no bleeding. There was no injuries. There was nothing. There were no ulcers. There was nothing there. The doctor, I think, said something like, well, I guess it must have been something you ate. Right. God healed her. Now, did he heal her of everything? No. We asked him about that. He hasn't given us exactly what his answer is yet. But it was a remarkable thing. She got out of the hospital. She had to stay then the next day. Got out Saturday. As she was leaving the hospital, or had a little bit of puffiness in the hand where the IVs had gone in, and a couple of nurses even mentioned as she was leaving, you know, you've got a little bit of infection there on your hand. Maybe you better get that taken care of here. And she had been let go. She wanted to get home, and her immunity was a risk there, but she went ahead and went home anyway. Got a call Sunday night. She's in trouble again. Arm is swollen up and infected, red streak going up the side. sore throat and setting in, and so her body was going on tilt again. And so I said, all right, headed over for the house. Got healed her before I even arrived. I got there, no red streak. Puffiness had reduced itself to about half by their own description, just in the time it took me to drive across town. Sore throat was totally gone, and Darlene is sitting there in the chair, and I said, well, let's do it. Let's go ahead and anoint you and thank God and ask him for his protection and your care. You know, you could very easily be discouraged by the trauma that remains, but there was very clear intervention in God's hand, by God's hand, on her behalf in a number of ways, and dramatically so. I mean, literally, from the time you could drive across town, the major symptoms of what she was being troubled with were gone. Satan's big lie is, it won't work. You're better off where you were. It'll never happen again. God's truth is, I am here, stand still. See the salvation of the Lord. Exodus 16 carries on with just a different circumstance because Israel continued to buy into Satan's lie. It says, as they journeyed from Elim, all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness. It says this was on the 15th day of the second month after they departed the land of Egypt. So 30 days after they were out there, 30 days after Passover, days of unleavened bread, and now they're out in the wilderness before God. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. The big lie will always be there. You couldn't possibly get healed. You couldn't possibly overcome your problem or your addiction. You can't possibly get rid of in your mind the abuse that you've suffered. You're just going to have to live with it. And yet, the big truth is that God is incredibly merciful and kind. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Egypt portrays sin. I think we understand that. Pharaoh portrays Satan. And so God was calling his people out of that, effectively out of the world of their day. But Satan wanted them to stay. He wanted them back. And so he tried to discourage them in their mind, to make them afraid. We keep the days of unleavened bread for the very same thing. The days of unleavened bread picture our going forward according to God's call, out of Egypt, out of this world system, and into God's presence and his care. Satan wants us to look back. In fact, he wants us to go back. In fact, better yet, what Satan really wants is for us to never actually leave. Just keep one foot back in that world so that we have a little connection when we need it. The big lie obscures the truth. If all we had was truth, then people look at it and say, well, thumbs up, I'm going to do it. Thumbs down, I don't care. But you have the truth, and so you just measure against that. But that would be a little too sanitary, wouldn't it, if it was all just cut and dry. The big lie obscures the truth and gives us an excuse. With the big lie, frankly, you can do whatever you really want to, because you have a way now to justify what it is that you want to do. Romans 1 describes people who, in knowing God, do not come into obedience to God and justify what it is that they really want to do. Romans 1, verse 18. It says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So we're now talking about the big lie, a suppression, a countering of the truth. Because what may be known of God is manifest or obvious to them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were they thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Pretending to be wise, they became as fools. They changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves. It says they exchanged the truth of God for the lie. What lie? The big lie, the one Satan tells. They exchanged the truth of God for the lie, worshipped and served the creature or creation rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. Verse 28. Even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. And then it gives a bunch of examples of things that are not fitting. But they turned over the truth of God for the lie, for Satan's message that he puts out. Now, I know people, and you do too, that are not in this category who still do not understand the truth. I know people who are absolutely sincere. In fact, in their lives, they are probably more dedicated than many of us. So there's a category of people who are absolutely sincere, doing what they believe to be true, but unfortunately, they have still bought in to the big lie. Why? Because that's the way they were raised. They were taught that from day one. This is good, even though it's not. This is right, even though it's impure. Follow in the way of this world and of this land. They are sincere, they are dedicated, but they've bought into the big lie because that is indeed what they have been taught to do. They were simply raised that way. Muslims grow up believing the big Muslim lie. What's the big Muslim lie? The big Muslim lie is that Ishmael was the son of promise, and that the descendants of Isaac are imposters. That's the Muslim lie. And it's what they have been taught, and their children have been taught. It's what they teach their grandchildren, and that is why they hate the Jews so. Catholics grow up believing the big Catholic lie. The Pope is the vicar of Christ, the vicar being the representative here on the earth, the messenger as such, the representative who carries out his plans and details. Protestants grow up believing the big Protestant lie. The big Protestant lie, I would say, the law is done away, just believe on Jesus Christ, would be the big Protestant lie. That's what they're taught. They grow up with it. It's institutionalized. It's put in place. And they believe it. Doesn't mean they're not sincere, but it doesn't mean they know the truth. Because the Bible shows very clearly that people have exchanged the truth of God for the lie that Satan put forth. This is Satan's world, and he offers every single person in it something to believe in that is a lie. We ran into the big lie in the church just a few short years ago. The big lie, as I would describe that, is nothing has really changed. We just do the same things now because we want to. That was the big lie. Now, there was a lot of details that were added to that, but the lie was, you know, what do you mean all these changes? What changes? We still do what we always did. There's no changes. It was the big lie. History has borne out just how big of a lie that really was, because everything now has changed. And we saw it coming. God hates that. Proverbs 6 describes God's wrath on lies and liars. Proverbs 6, verse number 16. Notice the focus here of this scripture and how much is repeated in terms of lying and the damage that is done. Proverbs 6:16. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. An abomination is something that absolutely defiles and destroys, and you don't even want it around. You want it just to be completely removed and cleansed. Proud look, lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift and running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies. You know, there's only seven things, and two of them are already lying. You think, well, isn't that a little redundant? Well, it's just it reinforces just how dramatic the effect is. And one who sows discord among brethren, which indeed a lie does as well. And it can be done in different ways. God hates lies. Liars need to be repentant to be forgiven. And the consequences socially and spiritually is absolutely enormous. When God describes the way that we are to worship him in John chapter 4, he shows that you cannot possibly worship God with a lie. John 4, verse 23, the hour is coming and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit. And those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth, and there is no other way. You have to worship him according to what he says and with a right heart. And you have to do so with God indeed working in us. You cannot worship God in any other way. 1 Corinthians 5, I read at the first day of unleavened bread, because it speaks about the days of unleavened bread being kept here. And in verse 8, it basically just rephrases this very same thing. Therefore, let us keep this feast, the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth, with a right heart and mind, and by doing the right things. Let us keep the feast, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. We can only worship God apart from a lie. If you look then at our society, at the world's cultural identity, you're going to see various issues. And I've had a chance with some of you in discussion, you know, when we have Sabbath services, we're standing up here talking, well, what's the lie in this? What's the lie in this? And it's been kind of fascinating to prepare this sermon. Evolution is a lie. But what specifically is the lie that is in evolution? The lie is physical existence is not dependent on God. That's the lie at the heart of evolution. Evolution's lie means that indeed you can have a creation without a creator. That's simply not possible. If you go down and study evolution at the cellular level, what you find is that the cell is so incredibly complex that you get to the point to where there's a minimum of functions, maybe 20, 30 functions, that all have to be working and exist at the exact same time. And without any single one of those functions, the cell cannot exist. And so it's not like you can get there Darwinian step at a time. Irreducible complexity is what the term is that has been coined for that. If you go to the other end of the spectrum at the level of the species, and you find that the species do not change from one species to the next, that they are independent of each other, and that they are stable, and that there is no macroevolution that even exists. So at the species level on the top and at the cellular level at the bottom, evolution does not exist. Abortion is a lie. But the specific lie of abortion is, we really don't know when life begins. That's the lie. And therefore, since we don't know when life begins exactly, if you want it, Laura, just, you know, Darla just had her baby. If you want it, it's a child. If you don't want it, then it's just tissue. Because the lie is that we really don't know when life begins. But that's a lie. Simply not true. That kind of lie, I think you have to want to believe. You have to have a reason. You have to want to abort, you have to want to have your personal rights absent your responsibilities, but you have to want to believe that kind of a lie. It doesn't make sense at all. It makes no sense. Anywhere you look in the world, you'll find those institutional lies firmly in place. I grew up in the 60s, so to speak, born 1951, but grew up in the 60s. What was the lie of the 60s? I mean, I asked Peter Little, we were talking in a group, I said, what was the lie of the 60s? And he just spit it right out. I mean, it was so clear. It's all right as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. That was the lie that underpinned the 60s culture of, I want to do drugs, I want to have sex, I want to do as I please, I want to be able to live in a commune, or I want to be able to travel, or I want to be able to sleep around, or I want to be able to be free, or I want to have sex with my same kind. Doesn't matter what it was. The unspoken part of that was, nothing ever hurts anybody, so you can do anything you want. But the lie was, it's all right as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. Look at political systems on a bigger scale. Communism. I looked it up in the dictionary just to see what's communism. Communism is a social system characterized by the absence of classes. And it says that that implies as well, or requires, that there is common ownership of the means of production. So the means of production and subsistence are owned by the people themselves. That's communism. And there are no classes. Communism has a lie at its heart. And that lie is that the economic controls are in the hands of the people. The very definition of communism contains the lie. It was also a little fib, like the waters in the lectern. Just a little fib. Who's the most prominent communist leader that was in USSR, what we called Russia? It was Stalin. The most prominent leader was Stalin of the communist system. I'll read you just a little bit about him and see just how flagrant and blatant the lie is. Thank you, John. For those on the microphone, I'm taking a drink. It takes a second here. During the quarter of a century preceding his death in 1953, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin probably exercised greater political power than any other figure in history, more than the Caesars, more than Charlemagne, more than any other figure in history. In 1928, 25 million rustic households were compelled to amalgamate in collective or state farms within a few years. Uncooperative peasants were arrested en masse, shot, exiled, or absorbed into the rapidly expanding network of Stalinist concentration camps and worked to death under atrocious conditions. Collectivization also caused a great famine in the Ukraine, yet Stalin continued to export the grain stocks that were a less cruel leader would have rushed to the famine-stricken areas. Some 10 million peasants may have perished through his policies during these years. All this is for the people. In late 1934, just when the worst excesses of Stalinism seemed to have spent themselves, Secretary General launched a new campaign of political terror against the very Communist Party members who had brought him to power. Stalin's political victims were numbered in tens of millions. Political victims. This has nothing to do with the famines and all of the other persecutions. His main motive was presumably to maximize his personal power. Though a high industrial output was indeed achieved under Stalin, Very little of it ever became available to the ordinary Soviet citizen, the people who owned the means of production by the definition of communism. Stalin's collectivization of agriculture did not produce, either during his lifetime or during the decades immediately following his death, positive economic results. Communism had as its root basis a big lie. We go over to China. Who is the most significant leader of China in the century as a communist nation? Mao Zedong. You can read the very, very same story about Mao Zedong that you read about Stalin, except it's in a little different way. Not maybe where he just went out and killed everybody personally, but they died just the same. Under Mao Zedong, they've broken up his time as a leader into eras, and they have a name for each one. One of the early ones was called the Great Leap Forward. He saw that Stalin was bringing Russia forward by building industry and production, and he wanted to compete with that. And so he decided that the way to catch up was just kind of to jump forward all in one great big leap. Just make a dramatic change in the nation in order to get there quickly. The Great Leap Forward, a misguided program aimed at increasing agricultural production and creating overnight economic success. The plan was to employ millions of farmers in the constructions of roads, dams, and backyard steel furnaces. But the only notable result from this plan was a sharp reduction in the amount of food being produced. Although the transfer of industry to local control began as the primary agenda in the Great Leap Forward, though causing an epidemic of famine, it wound up killing approximately 30 million people. Do you ever read about that historically, that 30 million people died in one particular stage of Mao Zedong's leadership in China? I looked up Britannica. You didn't even see any notes in there about this. It's like somebody went through and just sanitized history and removed any question of those things. I had to hunt to find things that actually gave some of the actual history of the land. The Great Leap Forward, in reality, forced China to take huge steps backwards in its economic and social development. This breakdown of Chinese society was a direct result of a totalitarian regime's effort to industrialize too rapidly, and the death count is reflective of the regime's blatant disregard for humanity. Why, I think we ought to just go over there and hold the Olympics or something. Why not? They'll take care of us. Cultural Revolution was another one of those eras that is recorded historically. The Red Guard Terror. As a result of the humiliation he had suffered after the fiasco of the Great Leap Forward, Mao sought a way to regain his former stature. He devised a scheme whereby all the ills that China was suffering at the time were blamed on closet capitalists who were hiding in government posts and within the Communist Party itself. In reality, the target for Mao's wrath were those he saw as his political enemies, which is exactly what Stalin did. Eventually, the campaign spread to include targeting members of the scientists and influential professors of universities who were accused of putting technical expertise ahead of correct political thinking. Where is it today that correct political correctness is becoming a passion in the universities of this land, in the media of this land? Political correctness is put ahead of historical accuracy, responsibility, and fairness. Thus began the great proletarian cultural revolution. Mao made his appeal directly to the people, enlisting grassroots support. He urged students to turn against their teachers, laborers to turn against their managers. Thus he claimed, this was claimed, necessary to remove the last vestiges of the bourgeois from modern Chinese society. High school rise into what became known as the Red Guard. Red Guard students had as their assigned task the job of ensuring the political purity of what was being taught by the teachers of their school. The students had the responsibility for the purity of the teaching at the school by their teachers. Now, is that chaos? Is that a recipe for destruction? It's part of the big lie. That with communism, we're in here to collectivize the resources for the good of the people. No, we're here to centralize them for the good of the elite at the expense of the people, and at the most brutal expense anyone could ever imagine. Only Satan could lie like that, and yet people believe him. They buy in and say, ah, this must be true. The result was chaos. Entire schools were closed by units of Red Guard students, flush with their newfound power. Soon the movement spread from the classroom out into the streets. Red Guard factions became little more than roving gangs, looting shops whose owners supposedly had not conformed to proper Maoist doctrine. Entire universities were shut down, and the professors paraded through the streets as examples of wrong-headed intellectuals. In some villages, even the wearing of eyeglasses could get one branded as an intellectual. The Cultural Revolution had a disastrous effect on the educational systems and the scientific community within China, an effect that was felt well into the late 80s. Those people in China who were between the ages of 15 to 25 during the period of the revolution are now referred to as the lost generation. This is because they are the ones who lost out, losing the chance for an education, losing the chance for a normal youth. The lies that Satan has told are disastrous, and there's no end to them. They underlie, again, every institution of this world. We saw more recently the impact of Tiananmen Square, but more recently, that was 1989. The reason we got to watch that on our TVs is because Gorbachev was arriving there for a summit, and all the news reporters and media had arrived ahead of time and had set up shop, and the demonstration took place right there in the square. And so all the cameras were focused when this thing rose up and it was beamed around the world. They slaughtered those people right there in front of at least some of the record that was then made. People believe a lie because Satan has fed them one. The communists throughout the czars in Russia because they wanted to make a better place, and what was installed in its place was indeed horrendous. Of course, we live in a good land, and I mean that sincerely, and we live in a good system, and maybe I don't mean that quite as sincerely, because the system is not equal to the land that God created. We live in a democracy and a free market economy. Now, actually, that's a theory because we're supposed to be a republic, but we're becoming more and more democratic, and the economy is rather heavily controlled. But for argument's sake, we call ourselves a democracy and a free market economy. What's the big lie in our system? What's the big lie at the basis of what we have? You know, I heard it expressed in one way in a recent political contest a few years back. It was expressed, it's the economy, stupid. Now, that's not the way I would word the lie, but that was a reference to where the focus was. The lie is this. Economics is determined by market forces, not moral choices. You understand what that means? Economics is driven by market forces, competition, not by moral choices. What that means is, if you want to make money, you can invest it in tobacco stock, because after all, we're just investing in companies that do business. If you want to get a job, you can go work for the casino, because after all, everybody has to eat. And so economics is now driven by what the market will bear, absent from, to a large degree at times, moral choice, which means you can work a man until just a year or two before he's able to retire, and then fire him, and then he goes without. That's not what God created for Israel in the Old Testament. What God created for Israel in the Old Testament was an economy that was held to a moral measure and based on God's law itself. I'm not obviously arguing for some other system besides that which we have as if it would matter. What we have is what we have. What we have is the best that there is that I'm aware of in this world. But we do have to understand that there is indeed a fundamental lie in the system. Another way that lie is expressed, which we take as positive sometimes, and it's partially true, but it goes like this. A rising tide lifts all ships. As the economy grows, everybody benefits, right? No. No, as the economy grows, the fact is there is incredible opportunity out there, but there is also a funneling of power and resource. And where does the power and the resource go? To those who have the money. And so now you have a society that is dominated by sports stars, rock stars. You have a society that is dominated by industrial businessmen who have great power and influence. Some wield their power very wisely. Some absolutely cause unbelievable destruction in people's retirement, their savings, their resource, their health plans are back, just wiped out and destroyed. Economics cannot be determined just by market force. Let the market decide. That's efficient, but it can also be very immoral. Revelation 18 describes some of the lamentation that takes place when Babylon is destroyed. Verse number 9, this great mercantile enterprise that rose this tide and lifted these great ships with it, and the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning. Verse 11, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Verse 15, the merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. And every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, the sailors, the truck drivers, the people who were part of the exchange and who gained from those things, doesn't mean it's wrong to be in business. That's not my point. It just said, as many as traded the sea stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? Every system on the face of this earth that is of this earth, as compared to what that God himself has established, has at its heart and core a big lie. God didn't put any of this world's systems in place. When God gave, again, Israel in the Old Testament an economic system, he gave them one that recognized the impact of sin. And the mighty men of Israel were not the merchants and the newscasters and the rock stars and the sports people. Frankly, the mighty men of Israel were the prophets and the priests. Because of the law and the accountability and the instruction and direction God gave them. Now, yes, there's plenty of times when they turned aside and gave God no service at all, but that wasn't God's fault. That was their fault. They bought into some other lie that Satan offered them, like, you can't do that. This won't work. This isn't going to make you fulfilled. Here, go ahead and try something else. Numbers 18. Notice where God, under this system, put the power and authority in this way. The economic authority as well. Numbers 18, verse 25. Then the Lord spake to Moses and said, thus speak thus to the Levites, and say to them, when you take from the children of Israel the tithes which I have given you from them as your inheritance, then you shall offer up a heave offering of it to the Lord, a tenth of the tithe. So they took the tithe in, and that was brought in, the increase of the land, and then they took a tenth of that. And your heave offering shall be reckoned to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor, and as the fullness of the winepress. Thus you shall also offer a heave offering to the Lord. So they were to tithe as well out of their tithes. And the Lord, from all your tithes which you receive from the children of Israel, and you shall give the Lord's heave offering to Aaron the priest. Do you know what that meant in terms of a percentage of the gross national product that was turned in terms of tithe, where the increase was that went into the priesthood as their authority and gift and sustenance by God? They had 1% of the domestic product that was considered increase year by year of the entire nation of Israel was brought in and given to the priests. That's where God put his power and authority, because that's where he kept his law. And that's where the accountability remained. They were not enriched by their own hand. Rather, it was because God chose to use them in a remarkable way. Every time we're on the road and I get in the car, it's close to the top of the hour, so I head for the news to see what's happening in Israel. I mean, hour by hour, day by day, the risks over there are enormous. There is a big lie at the heart of the problems today in the Middle East. That lie is that peace can be attained through an agreement. You just need the right one. If you keep talking, keep changing the options, keep discussing, maybe finally talk to the right person, put out a few confidence-building measures so that people take little itsy-bitsy baby steps toward each other, that you can find a way to have peace. That is a lie. It is a big one. Fostered by Satan, I believe, himself. The truth is that peace in this world only comes through dominion. Through the absolute either extinction of the enemy or foe, or through the total domination, or temporarily, if you can call the Cold War peace, temporarily through the stalemate to where people stand back and stare at each other for decades until circumstances change. The lie in the Middle East that I believe Satan himself has put in that system is that peace can be attained through an agreement. It cannot and it will not. Although the Bible does indicate that a covenant or a peace agreement or something will be at some point offered in the Middle East, but it will be very, very temporary indeed. What then is the lie for you and me? What lie has been fostered on us? What is it we contend with and we have to address in our mind? Revelation 18. I believe it is here. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, prison for every foul spirit, cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, and indeed, this is what God has called us to do. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive her plagues, for her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. God calls out, just like he called Israel, and said, I'm coming to get you, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, I want to deliver you from sin, I'm going to protect you from Satan, I want you to come and serve me. And God here calls out in the midst of this destruction of Babylon for his people, and says, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, lest you receive of her plagues. The lie is, don't worry, there's still time. Take advantage of the benefits of this society. Go ahead and enjoy Egypt. You're here. The lie is, take your leisure, take your pleasure. You might be blind. Well, let's go to Revelation 3. Because it talks about the Laodicean era, very much Revelation 3:14, in the end time. Verse 16, You're lukewarm, neither hot or cold. I'll spew you out of my mouth. You say, verse 17, I am rich. I have become wealthy. I have need of nothing. And you don't know that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined in the fire that you may be rich, white garments that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. As many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. Therefore be zealous and repent. The lie is, don't worry, you have time, enjoy yourself, take advantage of the opportunities. You don't have to worry about what's coming. Worry about today. Live your life. Enjoy. Take your pleasure. Take your leisure. A little time, a little folding of the hands. Just go out and imbibe. It's all here waiting at your beck and call. As Satan said, Christ, here, all these kingdoms I'll put before you if you fall down and worship me. The lie is that we're just fine right where we are. That's what the days of unleavened bread are all about. Countering the lie that we're just fine in Egypt. We are not just fine in Egypt. You can't leave one foot in Egypt. We leave Egypt behind. We walk away from Pharaoh, from Satan, from sin, and God says, come and serve me. That's the truth. And anything that opposes that or dilutes that or confuses that process is part of the big lie. We must never buy in to what Satan says. We must do as God says. Stand still to see the salvation of the Lord. Come to me, you who are burdened, heavy laden. I will give you rest. Worship me, and I will care for you, I will protect you, and I will lead you into the promised land. That's the days of unleavened bread.